Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. Red wolves are one of the most endangered mammals on the planet. Back in the 70s, there were fewer than 20 red wolves left in the wild. But a decades-long federal reintroduction effort boosted the population about tenfold. They lived in or around the 152,000-acre Alligator River National Wildlife Refuge on the North Carolina coast. By the early 2010s, the population started to decline. According to scientists at Antioch University and the University of Wisconsin, 69 red wolves were shot, either intentionally or accidentally, between 2009 and 2018, and another 30 vanished. In his latest investigation for The Nation, today's guest, environmental journalist Jimmy Tobias, says the story of the decline of the red wolf population is the story of how and why the United States Fish and Wildlife Service, the country's eminent conservation agency, walked away from its red wolf reintroduction program and let the wild wolf population collapse. The retreat started during the presidency of Barack Obama and continued under Donald Trump. He reports that today there are maybe 10, maybe 20 true red wolves left rambling across the landscape. And he asks, if the government is already struggling to protect iconic creatures like wolves from extinction in the wild, how will it handle the daunting future? Jimmy Tobias is a freelance reporter and a frequent Nation contributor who writes about extinction, extraction, and environmental justice. And you could read his latest investigation for The Nation called The Collapse of Wild Red Wolves is a Warning That Should Worry Us All. Hi, Jimmy. Welcome back to the show, and thanks for another important investigation.
Thanks for having me back, Rose.
Well, before we dive in and talk about your work on red wolves, I wanted to ask you about your February investigation about the endangered Florida panthers' fight for survival. We had you on talking about that report, and you say that a proposed development funded by big money and special interests could seriously damage the panthers' habitat, even shoving it toward extinction. You reported at that time that there are only 120, maybe 130 Florida panthers left in the wild. Can you give us an update on this story?
Yeah, I mean, right now everyone's sort of just waiting to see what's going to happen. The government hasn't made a determination yet on whether to effectively sanction this large development in panther habitat. And so it's taken a surprisingly long time for a decision to be forthcoming. And I think that's because they're wrestling with a lot of major implications of this development and haven't yet come down with an answer. So yeah, we're still sort of waiting to see what's going to happen. And I'm certainly following that.
Well, you can find that conversation at yourcallradio.org. So let's talk about your latest investigation. Why did you decide to focus on red wolves? It's really an amazing piece. And then just learning about red wolves and the beauty of red wolves. We've got a photo of one on our website.
Yeah, well, you know, I was interested in what happened to this program, you know, because it was the first major effort in U.S. history to restore a wild carnivore to the landscape. It was sort of an iconic program. And, you know, it involves a species that's one of the most endangered mammals, as you said, in the world. And so I wanted to, you know, I'd been hearing about red wolves and their plight for some time, and I wanted to see for myself what actually happened here.
So let's just talk about red wolves, a couple facts about red wolves. Talk a little bit about their characteristics. The red wolf is distinctly a different species from the gray wolf. The red wolf's historical range included the southeastern U.S. from southern Missouri south to Texas, across the Gulf states, and into North Carolina. So tell us just some facts about what you learned about the red wolf.
Yeah, this is a species of wolf endemic to the United States, smaller than a gray wolf. They mostly historically lived in the southeast, and some even ranged up towards the northeast. And so they, you know, they occupied a particular part of the United States. But they were, you know, they're not as well known, I would say, as gray wolves. But you know, they were a major part of the eastern United States' ecosystem. And by the mid 20th century, you know, they had mostly been wiped out by predator control efforts, poisoning, by habitat destruction, but mostly by persecution from humans. And so they were really, they were on the verge of going extinct by the middle of the 20th century. And then in 1973, the Endangered Species Act was passed. And that sort of began their slow restoration thanks to government efforts.
And I'm just reading now from the National Wildlife Federation. Red wolves are lean, often with black-tipped bushy tails. Their coats are mostly a brown or buff color with some black along their backs. There's sometimes a reddish tint to the fur on their muzzle behind their ears. At a glance, a red wolf may look somewhat like a domestic German shepherd. They're between the size of a gray wolf and a coyote, about 4 feet long. They stand at about 26 inches at the shoulder, and they weigh between 45 and 80 pounds. And then they prey on small animals, such as rabbits, raccoons, squirrels, and small deer. Anything else you can tell us just about red wolves and what we should know about them? Also, another one is the pups are born between late April and early May with an average litter size of 2 to 6 pups.
Yeah, and you know, they're like wolves in general. They need large landscapes to do well. They're habitat generalists. They can survive in a lot of different conditions. And something else with red wolves that has caused some problems with conserving them is that they can hybridize with coyotes. And so that has been one of the things that has threatened, you know, their genetic integrity in recent decades.
And so why is it that these wolves are in just North Carolina? Because the historical range included the southeastern U.S. from southern Missouri south to Texas.
Yeah, well, what happened was after the species was listed under the Endangered Species Act, the federal government went in. In a very bold gambit, it pulled hundreds of animals out of the wild, hundreds of red wolves out of the wild, and you know, analyzed their genes, and it found that there, of all those animals they pulled out, there were 14 true, you know, pure red wolves. And so the government pulled those wolves into a captive breeding program to, you know, to stop them from going extinct. I mean, they were really on the verge of going extinct. And so from those 14 wolves, the government saved them from extinction. And then, like, about a decade later, in the mid-80s, they launched a reintroduction effort. And they actually reintroduced them in several places. But the place where they thrived was in North Carolina, in and around the Alligator River National Wildlife Refuge, which is on the coast of North Carolina. And so that's the place that really became the center of this reintroduction effort. And for several decades, it was an enormous success. I mean, from those 14 individuals, you know, the very last red wolves on the planet, they rebuilt this population in Alligator River National Wildlife Refuge.
It's just so interesting to learn about how these programs work. You write that between 1987 and 2014, 134 wolves were released into Alligator River. And the Fish and Wildlife Service initiated a program to sterilize the region's growing coyote population, which threatened to dilute the red wolf's gene pool through interbreeding. And you touched on that a bit earlier. With a team of field biologists and about $1 million a year in funding, the program just really, really took off at that point. They said that it was remarkably successful.
Yeah, I mean, by 2007, the agency, you know, declared that the wild red wolf population had climbed to nearly 130 individuals, and you know, they deemed it an enormous success at the time. But that was before things took a turn.
And so that started happening in the 2010s. Well, actually, you say the trouble began in earnest in 1990. And you write about meeting with a farmer in Hyde County, which is a rural part of North Carolina. And this farmer did not want to reveal his name. Tell us what you learned about what this farmer told you and how other farmers feared that the red wolf would threaten their livestock.
Yeah, you know, there has been opposition in the area to red wolves quite a bit, a very vocal opposition from a small group of people in particular. But yeah, I met with a farmer in Hyde County, and you know, he told me kind of his perspective on what he thought happened with the program. And one of the things that sort of kicked off animosity towards the wolf was a prosecution by the government of a farmer who shot and killed a red wolf on his land because, you know, he claimed in a court filing that he feared the wolf would threaten his livestock. And the government prosecuted him for the killing and he pled guilty. And I think that got a lot of people upset about the program. Seeing, you know, one of their neighbors get prosecuted. And there were other things as well that added to the controversy, he told me, including an effort in 2013 when conservation groups sued in court to reverse a decision by local government that allowed pretty permissive coyote hunting practices in the area because red wolves were being killed accidentally by hunters during nighttime hunts and other things. And so, you know, those sorts of things, I think, created suspicion towards the program. But really what pushed what ended up damaging the program very badly was an effort by a pretty small but vocal group of individuals who wanted to see the program end altogether. And they, you know, leveraged connections to Republican officials in North Carolina after 2013 when the GOP took control of the state government. And they also found sympathetic ears within the Fish and Wildlife Service itself, who ultimately ended up sort of torpedoing the program from the inside.
You write specifically about Jet Farabee, who has a history of donations to state Republicans in North Carolina. He helped amplify the conflict over the wolves. His property sits near a string of federal wildlife refuges. He and other opponents of this program accused the Federal Wildlife Service of fraud, of wasting taxpayer money, of operating illegally. So tell us more about Jet Farabee.
Yeah, well, you know, he and others in the area where these wolves were reintroduced did not want them around in their community. And, you know, under the federal government's regulations governing this whole program, private landowners could request that red wolves be removed from their property at any time. And so, you know, a lot of the initial pushback to the program sort of took the form of people coordinating on internet forums to flood to flood the agency with requests for removal of wolves from their property, pressuring the agency to constantly remove wolves from their property, and just generally, you know, going after the program in all its, you know, in all its elements, you know, accusing the agency of fraud, of all sorts of things, of wasting money, of operating illegally. And, you know, this small group of people were very committed to what they were doing, were very, you know, vocal, had connections to local politicians. And so they were able to bring a lot of pressure to bear on the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service during the Obama administration.
So let's talk a little bit more about the Fish and Wildlife Service. You told us a lot about the Fish and Wildlife Service and how it affected the panther in Florida. And again, in this story, you reveal a lot about what goes on behind the scenes. You write that the story of the red wolf is really emblematic of a Fish and Wildlife Service that's increasingly loath to govern, all too often folding under pressure from powerful interests. First off, can you just give us some general information about the Fish and Wildlife Service, how it runs, and the politics involved?
Yeah, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is an agency within the Department of the Interior, and it has many responsibilities. It operates national wildlife refuges around the country. It operates the federal duck stamp program. And, you know, perhaps its most important responsibility, it enforces the Endangered Species Act for terrestrial plants and animals. And so it's really, you know, it's really the principal wildlife conservation agency at the federal level within the United States. And so it has an enormous amount of responsibilities, and it's charged with preserving and protecting endangered and threatened species like the red wolf, like the Florida panther, and others. But, you know, like as with many federal agencies, you know, its mandate can be very controversial. There's a lot of interest groups out there that are pretty deeply opposed to the Endangered Species Act and the regulations that come with it. And so this is an agency that's constantly under political pressure to water down species protections, to, you know, find ways around the strictures of the ESA, which is a very powerful environmental law that unfortunately in recent decades has lost a lot of its power because of sort of weak enforcement and weak leadership at the federal level. And so there's many examples of this. I point in the Red Wolf story to the fact that, you know, here's an agency that's permitted the destruction of tens of thousands of acres of endangered Florida panther habitat in recent decades. It almost never deploys some of its most powerful regulatory tools. You know, it resists listing many kinds of animals as endangered. It's an agency that is struggling. And I think that this Red Wolf story, as I said, is sort of emblematic of that fact, because here's this iconic reintroduction program that the agency sort of just walked away from under pressure, despite having, you know, legal authority to keep these animals alive in the wild in North Carolina.
Today we are speaking with Jimmy Tobias, a reporter and frequent Nation contributor who writes about extinction, extraction, and environmental justice. His latest investigation for the Nation is called "The Collapse of Wild Red Wolves is a Warning That Should Worry Us All." He reports that there are maybe 10, maybe 20 true red wolves left rambling across the landscape today. And he raises an important question. If the government is struggling to protect these iconic creatures from extinction, how will it handle the daunting future? Because we know that so many animals are going extinct. We're losing just so many incredible animals. Jimmy, talk a little bit about the Fish and Wildlife Service under the Obama administration, the Trump administration, and then where we are right now. You actually interviewed Dan Ash, who was director of the Fish and Wildlife Service for much of the Obama administration, and oversaw its initial pullback from the Red Wolf program. So what did he tell you? What was his explanation?
Well, you know, he said that this was a decision they made. I mean, they made a decision to effectively pull the plug on this Red Wolf program, at least the reintroduction portion of it. So basically what happened, under pressure from, you know, this small vocal group of residents in North Carolina, as well as the state government, the Fish and Wildlife Service in 2015 did several things, one of which is it gave several private landowners for the first time ever the permission to kill red wolves on their property. And one wolf was killed by a private landowner or his agent. It also stopped reintroducing wolves. So in 2015, the agency sort of quietly just stopped reintroducing red wolves in the wild in North Carolina. And stopped its coyote sterilization efforts. And so what happened was the red wolf population collapsed. I mean, you know, back in the 70s, when the government went in to save the species, there were 14 real red wolves left in the wild. They built that number up to with millions of dollars and millions of dollars, unknown numbers of work hours. They built that population up to about 130 wolves by 2007. And then it all collapsed. And now there's maybe 10, maybe 20 wolves roaming the landscape. So it's pretty much back to where it was in terms of wild wolves on the landscape. Now there are wolves that are kept in zoos and other facilities and captive bred. So the species is not in danger of going extinct per se, but it is in danger of going extinct in the wild. And so really all that effort, all that creativity and time that went into building up this population was just let go by the agency under during the Obama administration. And so it's just, I think, you know, it's fair to say it's sort of a tragedy.
It is a tragedy. Can you tell us more about how this permit, the first permit, was actually issued? We talked a little bit about Jet Farabee, who, again, has a history of donations to state Republicans and really amplified the conflict over wolves. He wanted this program to stop. And you report that Leo Miranda was one of the Fish and Wildlife Service's highest ranking leaders. And according to court records submitted by conservation groups, Leo Miranda first interacted with Jet Farabee in 2013 when Farabee sent him and others an email demanding that the wolves be removed from his property. And when he asked for wolf removal, he wanted a lethal take permit, which would allow him or a designated agent to trap or shoot the wolves themselves. And you said that a permit like this had never been issued to a private individual in the history of the program. So take it from there. How did this all unravel, and how did he eventually get this permit?
Yeah, well, Leo Miranda issued the first permit to a private individual for lethal take, and that person was Jet Farabee. Now, my understanding is that he never acted on that lethal take permit, but that set a precedent. And in June 2014, all these other folks started asking the Fish and Wildlife Service for the same sort of permit, and it issued one to an anonymous private individual who did end up taking. Killing a wolf on his property. And that moment to me, it was the killing of the wolf took place in the summer of 2015. And that was right about the time where the agency also, kind of pulled the plug on the reintroduction effort and the coyote sterilization efforts. It all sort of happened around the same, time. And so the killing of the wolf by a private individual in the summer of 2015, to me, is sort of, was sort of a symbol of the way that the program, took a radical turn and started to collapse. There were some people like Leo Miranda inside the Fish and Wildlife Service who were very sympathetic to those who were not fans of the Red Wolf Reintroduction Program. And, Mr. Miranda and others were highly placed individuals. And so they were able to sort of, steer the program in a different direction, and that direction, led to the collapse of the program and the population. It was an example of the agency coming under pressure from a small but vocal and powerful group of individuals, and basically, doing as they wished, and the program suffered for it. I mean, the wolves disappeared, more or less, except for a few survivors. And so that's sort of where things stand today with a few new updates. But that's why this story is sort of emblematic, because this is not the only time or the only example of this sort of thing happening.
You actually start your piece by focusing on this red wolf that was shot. You report that this red wolf was a 6-year-old matriarch with a mate and a large family. She'd already given birth several times before, and the evidence suggests she may have been caring for more newborns in the wet coastal forests that flourish near North Carolina's Outer Banks. She and her family were supposed to be safe, as you report, thanks to this Endangered Species Act, which makes it a crime to harm or harass listed animals like red wolves. But she was shot down by a private landowner, and you actually got your hands on a government autopsy of this wolf.
Right, yeah. And, it showed that she was a healthy wolf. I didn't see any indication that she was, causing any particular problems. It was just that the government relented and gave someone permission to kill this mother wolf. It was sort of the moment where things took a turn. I mean, it was that summer where the program started to unravel, more or less, and it has never really recovered.
And the official name, the human name of this red wolf is 11768F. And you can find more information and read Jimmy Tobias's really important story at yourcallradio.org. It's called "The Collapse of Wild Red Wolves is a Warning That Should Worry Us All." Jimmy Tobias is a freelance reporter and a frequent Nation contributor who writes about extinction, extraction, and environmental justice. Today, we are telling the story, thanks to Jimmy's reporting, about red wolves. This is Your Calls One Planet series. We'll be back after this. This is Your Calls One Planet series. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are talking about the plight of red wolves in the U.S. Jimmy Tobias is a frequent Nation contributor who writes about extinction, extraction, and environmental justice. You can find his latest piece for the Nation. It's called "The Collapse of Wild Red Wolves is a Warning That Should Worry Us All." The link is at yourcallradio.org. And now we would like to welcome Ron Sutherland to the show. Ron is chief scientist at the Wildlands Network. Their mission is to reconnect, restore, and rewild North America so that life in all its diversity can thrive. Ron Sutherland leads the development of new habitat connectivity models for the southeastern U.S. and coordinates efforts to map the entire eastern wildway. He also directs an extensive camera trapping project in the Red Wolf Recovery Area in North Carolina and is an enthusiastic public advocate for red wolf conservation. Hi, Ron. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. First off, Ron, can you tell us why you're so passionate about red wolves?
Sure. Well, I grew up in North Carolina, and I've been in the state where it's all happened. You know, I remember hearing about it in the 80s when they were first putting the wolves out there at Alligator River, and I was pretty young at the time, but, you know, sort of tracked it over the years. Didn't realize I was going to end up working on red wolves one day, but and then, you know, I joined Wildlands Network in 2010. And we've got our mission that you just recited. You know, we have a great concern for the Southeast that we're missing some species like the red wolf. And so I dove into thinking about how we could work on red wolf conservation. And, you know, things seemed quiet from 2010 to 2012 or so. But and then suddenly things weren't quiet anymore. Around 2012, I kind of went to a public meeting or two and realized that there was this opposition movement that was bubbling up against the red wolf. And little did I know that was going to be a very successful opposition movement. And, I think I would have done more in 2012 and 2013 if I had known where things were headed, but we certainly dove in. At one point, we started our camera project out there in 2015 and started doing camera trapping. And I was out there with my son, I think in the winter of 2015, 2016, And we were out at the Alligator River National Wildlife Refuge after dark. We were checking all these cameras, and it was cold. It was January, and the stars were out. And I was bent over, hunched over in the dark, trying to get the batteries out of this camera. And then the red wolves started howling behind me, and they were probably about a quarter mile away. And at the time, you know, this was the population was still pretty robust. There was a very healthy pack at Alligator River. And it's just an electrifying experience. And it was one that I got my son to enjoy and hear that. And I really want other people to be able to hear red wolves in the wild, not just in North Carolina, but in other places around the Southeast. And so that moment has really stuck with me in terms of dedication to this species. And it's not that we want to recover them just for humans, but you know, they're intrinsically just an amazing, amazing species, millions of years of evolution, and they belong here in the Southeast.
Right. It's such an important point. I can't imagine to think that there are 10, maybe 20 red wolves left and you've seen them. I mean, that must be, on many levels, it's a very sad experience knowing that there are so few left, but it must be such an amazing experience at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, as Jimmy's article relates in the Nation, you know, we were super ecstatic to see the wolves back in March. And I've seen them a few more times this summer. We had some interns out that turned out to have very good fortune in finding red wolves this summer. And it's incredible to see something like that. But at the same time, it just really hits you when you stop and think about what tin means. I mean, conservation biologists, you know, thinking about a population that's down to under 20 animals in the wild, you just don't even know what to do with something like that. Really, it's so beyond the level of sustainability for that population. So right. There's really an urgent need to do something to get more wolves out there on the ground, which is what we've been pushing for.
Jimmy, you were with Ron and his two kids when you saw the two red wolves. What was that experience like for you?
Yeah, I mean, it was very exciting. Not, you know, somewhat unexpected. We traveled around the National Wildlife Refuge one afternoon, and it was kind of towards the end of our time out there, and we decided to go on like one more little loop to look, you know, in one last spot before we started heading back. And we just, you know, there they were out in the field, and it was very exciting. I mean, I had never seen a wolf before then, so I was obviously thrilled, you know, and yeah, it was very lucky and very a very special moment.
Yeah, I can't imagine. Can you tell us, Ron? We talked with Jimmy about the politics, about, gosh, some of these powerful farmers who say that the red wolves are going to get in the way of their livestock, of the, you know, Republicans winning control of North Carolina in 2013, and critics of the program found new allies at the highest levels of state government. And then, of course, you've got the politics around the Fish and Wildlife Service. Given that you're in the trenches there, what do you want people to know who might not be familiar with the politics around? Like, some people would say, why would anyone want to stop a program that would reintroduce red wolves into the wild? What do people need to know about the politics and what has gone on behind the scenes?
That's a great question. I think fundamentally, we're still scratching our heads a bit about why some people are so worked up about the red wolf program, because if you actually look at the impacts on farmers in that region, they're really, really small. This area that we're talking about in coastal North Carolina, it's basically sort of Kansas flat, and it's just these huge 1,000-acre, 5,000-acre farms that grow corn and soybeans, cotton, things like that. And the wolves are not interfering with that in any way. In fact, you know, deer are pretty significant crop pests down there, and the wolves, you know, presumably help produce that crop predation a little bit. So that in theory, they should be a net positive for the folks out there. And you know, the level of livestock production is extremely low in this region. So it's not like, you know, the gray wolf situation out west, which is also really overblown. But here, there's just, you know, no cows and goats to speak of, really. There's just a tiny number. So the wolves have been minding their own business. They haven't hurt anyone in the 34 years they've been reintroduced out there. And the level of opposition, you know, we think in some ways it's opposition to the federal government and what that represents. There's a lot of folks that are keen to sort of paint the Red Wolf program as a government experiment, when really it's this last ditch sort of noble effort to save a species that we ourselves, humans, have brought to the brink of extinction.
What would you say about the Fish and Wildlife Service? Because Jimmy reports, you know, based on all the people he interviewed, had the Fish and Wildlife Service stood its ground on this program, things might be very different today.
Well, Jimmy's right. And it's not the Red Wolf team on the ground. They have stood sort of steadfast in doing what they can to try to save the red wolves. But the leadership of the Fish and Wildlife Service, from the regional office in Atlanta on up into the national office and above, they really kind of sold out on the species, starting in that sort of 2013 range. Once there was starting to be some opposition, organized opposition down there, and the state of North Carolina started at the Wildlife Commission of the state of North Carolina started saying, hey, can you stop this red wolf program, which was a politically motivated resolution that came out there. The Fish and Wildlife Service, you know, demoralized and somewhat weakened by years of congressional budget cuts. They were like, okay, we'll make North Carolina happy and we'll stop this red wolf program. Essentially, that's what happened, is they decided they would give up, maybe focus on some other species. And they've sort of intentionally collapsed the program. They stopped releasing wolves into the wild in 2015. They stopped doing coyote management to try to pr- prevent the wolves and coyotes from hybridizing. Also in 2015, they, you know, canned the job of the Red Wolf Recovery Coordinator, and, you know, a whole litany of things that have led very directly to the population collapsing. And we heard, you know, sort of through the grapevine in 2014 or so, that the strategy, internal strategy of the Fish and Wildlife Service was going to be to neglect the Red Wolf program into out of existence. And once it was gone, or once it was so small that they, you know, they could argue that they'd have to pull the plug, then they couldn't be sued, because that's what they're worried about, is conservation groups could sue them if they were doing the wrong thing. If the species just sort of wipes itself out, or at least appears to be wiping itself out, which is certainly more true, then they thought they could get away with it. And here we are 7 years later, and that's pretty much what has happened. You know, recent victories to the contrary. But.
So a lot of this happened under the Obama administration, and Jimmy interviewed Dan Ash, who led the Fish and Wildlife Service at that time. And I was just reading the press release when he was confirmed. He worked with the Fish and Wildlife Service from June 2011 to January 2017. So it's not like he was an outsider, whereas the Trump administration appointed, and the Senate, Republican Senate, confirmed a former Monsanto employee, Aurelia Skipwith, to run the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So tell us more about Daniel Ash. And we talked about, you know, why this happened. So many special interests pushing the Fish and Wildlife Service. But, you know, why? What else happened under the Obama administration that made them walk away from this program?
It's a great question. I think, for me personally, it was one of the more disappointing things about the Obama administration was the way they treated certain wildlife programs, and the Red Wolf was case in point. And at the time, I feel like we heard that Dan Ash, you know, gave a speech or two at a conference where he basically said there were some species that we were just going to have to give up on. They weren't going to thrive. They were going to focus on species that were going to do well. And, you know, I don't know who fed him that narrative, but the Red Wolf itself, the Red Wolf program, had been quite the successful effort. It was the first successful effort to reintroduce a large carnivore into the wild. And, you know, the population grew really well from 1987 to 2006. And, you know, there was no reason to think that we couldn't keep on growing the Red Wolf program, doing the right things to keep the species alive in the wild. But instead, they just sort of decided to give up on it. And I think, you know, perhaps Dan was being fed some misinformation from below, from the regional office level, where the folks were very keen, it seemed, on making North Carolina happy and making I wouldn't say farmer. There's one particular guy who was like a real estate developer, and who's very wealthy, and he's taken it on himself to end the program. And the regional office has, for the last almost 10 years, made it their priority to make this wealthy real estate developer happy instead of saving the Red Wolf, instead of promoting the taxpayers' investment in recovering this species.
Jimmy, to go back to the interview you did with Dan Ash, who again directed the Fish and Wildlife Service for much of the Obama administration, said there was just a whole series of events that were going on in and around the Red Wolf Recovery Program that warranted taking a look at whether we could be successful with the Red Wolf, given the resources available to us and given the political environment within North Carolina, an environment he describes as hostile. What else really struck you about what Dan said about what happened with this program?
Well, you know, I think in general, you know, a lot of people look back on the Obama administration and view his record, that administration's record on wildlife, as not great. I mean, I think, you know, you talk to people, you know, retirees from the Fish and Wildlife Service, conservation groups and others, and I think there's a sense that the Obama administration was just not willing to spend political capital on controversial wildlife issues. And it's not just the red wolves. I mean, it's other species too, the greater sage grouse, wolverines. I mean, the list is actually pretty long, but this is just such a clear example of them, you know, sort of taking the easy way out rather than, you know, trying to stand up for these species with the legal authority that they had under the Endangered Species Act. I mean, they didn't have to do by any means what they did. They had the authority to keep things going. but that's just not that just wasn't their priority. It seems like I heard somebody said that, you know, in past administrations, you know, if there's someone in the White House who really cares about wildlife and can provide, you know, air cover to the Fish and Wildlife Service, and that's when the Fish and Wildlife Service tends to do well. But when that air cover from the White House doesn't exist, then the Fish and Wildlife Service really struggles. And I think it didn't really exist during the Obama administration.
So then under Trump, like I said, they confirmed and appointed a Monsanto employee, Aurelia Skipwith, to direct U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And Jimmy, you report that the Trump administration set about rewriting the regulations that govern the Red Wolf program, hoping to radically reduce its mandate and confine the last remaining animals to federal land. It did not complete the job before being booted from office. And so what about the Biden administration? Just last week, the Center for Biological Diversity put out a press release with 55 organizations urging President Biden to nominate a permanent director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. What can we expect from the Biden administration, Jimmy?
Well, I think the jury is definitely still out on the Biden administration. I mean, you know, as your listeners probably know, we're facing a very serious extinction crisis, you know, where, you know, up to a million species are going to be threatened with extinction in the decades to come. And so it's a really big problem, but it's still unclear whether the Biden administration is going to take on that issue with the urgency it deserves. I haven't seen any major change of course on the Red Wolf program that wasn't sort of forced by conservationist lawsuits. And I think it's still, and they haven't even nominated a director for the agency yet. So I feel like until they do nominate someone and get someone confirmed, the Fish and Wildlife Service is just going to be treading water. More or less. Really, the honest answer is that the jury is definitely still out.
What are your thoughts on this, Ron? Brett Hartle, Government Affairs Director with the Center for Biological Diversity, says North America's wildlife is in crisis, so it's distressing that President Biden has not named a director to confront this emergency. The Fish and Wildlife Service was left rudderless for most of the Trump administration with profoundly harmful consequences, and that cannot happen again. So what are your thoughts, Ron?
Well, I say on the positive, they have put in a really solid Secretary of the Interior, and so that's encouraging. And if she is able to appoint her own pick for the directorship of the Fish and Wildlife Service, then I would have some confidence that that person is going to be on the right side of things and helping push for wildlife. I'm sympathetic with the agency in some ways in terms of the way that Congress has treated them over the past 20 or 30 years. We've got all these wildlife refuges and you know, literally thousands of endangered species. They need a significant budget increase to really be able to tackle that job. But at the same time, you know, I think there are some just lingering malignant forces inside the agency that just don't have conservation as their goal. And so that's the frustrating thing is it's going to take some time to sort of right the ship and get folks focused on energetically pursuing conservation. Because it's kind of hard, you know, if you go back to the 80s, it's hard to imagine now in 2021, even though we know so much more about conservation and the importance of biodiversity, you know, can we imagine releasing starting another reintroduction project for red wolves in some other southeastern state? You know, with the level of bravery that we've seen in the Fish and Wildlife Service the last couple of decades, it's really hard to imagine that. So we need a kind of a sea change to get back to where we were even in the 80s, where we were not afraid of getting out there and trying to recover these species.
We have a couple questions from listeners. Alan writes, what are the predators of the red wolf? Do you want to take that one, Ron?
Sure. Yeah. So red wolves are, you know, we see them as top carnivores. I think healthy adult red wolves have few predators in the wild. Humans are certainly the exception there, and human caused mortality via bullets and also via cars. There's been a rash of roadkill incidents this summer that's been very disappointing. But in the wild, I think alligators probably come to mind as the one thing that can really take out an adult red wolf.
Oh, alligators.
There's not that many down there, so it's, wow. It's just a small thing. It's, they live at Alligator River National Wildlife Refuge, but as few red wolves as there are, we've actually seen as many red wolves as we have alligators out there. So it's, I think, left to their own devices, the red wolves could pretty much live pretty long, healthy lives out there.
Wow. Well, we know they all need to eat, but the visual of an alligator eating a red wolf, wow. And then there's another question from Alan. Do Florida black panthers interact with red wolves? Jimmy, do you know?
Well, actually, the Florida panther, the Fish and Wildlife Service at least designates the Florida panther as a subspecies of a cougar. So they're not actually black panthers. They're more, they're cougars, basically. And they're a distinct population down there that the government considers a subspecies at this time. I don't know about the interaction between, historically, it seems like red wolves and panther habitat would have overlapped, but I don't know what their interaction would be. I imagine it'd be something similar to the interaction between, cougars out west and gray wolves. But I'm not sure what that looks like.
Ron, any ideas?
I would agree with Jimmy. I think that's, I think we'd look to the gray wolf cougar relationship, which is, they don't always get along, but they certainly can coexist out there. And so I think that's what you'd see. And, I think the important thing is to shoot for a future where we could actually see that interaction. Because right now the Florida panther is stuck in extreme South Florida. The red wolf is stuck in coastal North Carolina. And, there's lots of places in between where we could have both and we could recover both. It'd be great someday to be able to go and visit a place in the Southeast that would have its full suite of wolves and panthers restored.
Well, let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Marie Louise in Palo Alto. Hi, Marie Louise. Thanks for holding.
Thank you. Good morning. Yes. What I wanted to mention is that wolves consume a lot of rodents, and the farmers would, I would think that they would appreciate that. So I wanted to mention that because they actually consume a lot of rodents. And then if I could also add that the way I feel about wolves is a bit like how I feel about elephants, even though they're far from related. But wolves have this family hierarchy even, but they live as a family and they depend upon each other. And thank you so much for having this program today. It's very good to hear. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Marie Louise. It's great to hear from you. Ron, what are your comments?
Definitely right on the money. The wolves actually do eat a fair number of rodents, including some rodents of unusual size out there. There's a thing called a nutria, which is somewhere between a large muskrat and a small capybara. And it was introduced from South America, and they've kind of taken over down there. And the wolves see them as these, giant morsels of energy, and the wolves love them. And the farmers, a few farmers at least, have gone on the record saying that they appreciate the fact that the wolves are eating these nutria and helping reduce the number of holes that get dug through the nutria burrowing animals. I think the nutria have made it out to the West Coast, surprisingly. And so some of your listeners might be familiar with them. But, the wolves eat them, and they help control them. The wolves eat all kinds of things out there. We've actually started a project to look at potential beneficial impacts of the wolves on bobwhite quail. The quail in the Southeast, big game species, really popular with hunters. There used to be lots of quail hunting plantations around the region. Yeah, but quail numbers have gone south for decades. And one of the reasons we think is that the quail nests on the ground, they're vulnerable to nest predators like raccoons. And the raccoon populations have exploded in part because they're being subsidized by humans and getting human food, but also because there's been no top carnivores to keep the raccoon populations in check. And so we're doing research out there at Alligator River the past two summers, documenting quail populations, documenting the red wolf populations, and using cameras for the wolves and also to track raccoon populations. And so we're going to try to tie sort of this indirect link between having more wolves on the landscape leading to more quail, which would be a a really beneficial result for the red wolf in terms of PR.
Wow. It's really all connected. And to Marie-Louise's second point, the pack is a very close family unit and red wolves mate for life, which is amazing to think about. Thank you for that, Marie-Louise. Jimmy, final thoughts. We've got about a minute left. What is next for red wolves?
Yeah, well, you know, I think a lot depends on the Biden administration. I mean, if they want to take a different course, if they want to, you know, recommit to the Red Wolf program, find new reintroduction locations as well, they could. They have it. They certainly have it within their authority under the Endangered Species Act. And so I think that it's I don't think it's too late for this species in the wild. I think it's a very perilous moment for them. Obviously, their numbers are so low, but I think they could change course. But that, you know, in my view, that will require a rethink of sort of the agency culture at the Fish and Wildlife Service, the kind of leadership that you know this administration wants to see at the Fish and Wildlife Service, and you know ultimately. This administration will be responsive to voters who care about these animals and others like them. And so, you know, it's really up to the public more than anything, I think, to change the course here. I mean, the Fish and Wildlife Service kind of tried to pull the plug on this program in a somewhat quiet fashion, and they didn't quite get away with it. So I think, you know, I think there's still some degree of hope for this species in the wild.
Jimmy Tobias is a contributor to The Nation. You can find his latest piece, The Collapse of Wild Red Wolves is a Warning That Should Worry Us All, at yourcallradio.org. We've also been joined by Ron Sutherland, Chief Scientist at the Wildlands Network. Jimmy and Ron, thank you both for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. We'll be right back.